You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Today's passage comes right after one of the classics in the Lunkhead repertoire. Jesus and the disciples are on the road, and the lackeys are quietly arguing over which one of them is going to be the greatest. They all get back to Jesus' bachelor pad in Capernaum, and Jesus says, "Go on. What were you talking about back there on the road?" "Uh-huh. Really?" Jesus then sits down and, shaking his head, reminds them, "Anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all." To emphasize his point, he puts a child in front of them, which, remember, in the first century, is not a symbol of potential or value of any kind. It's something that is worth only what you can sell it for in the market. And Jesus says, when you welcome this child, who is on the absolute lowest rung of the social ladder, you welcome me. And then we get to our passage today, where Lunkhead in chief, John, oblivious to what Jesus has just said, and ever eager to one up the other disciples, raises his hand and says, Jesus, look at me. To which you can only imagine Jesus putting his head in his hands and sighing, "Ah, good grief."
Our words of wisdom are from Mark chapter 9, verses 38 through 41.
John said to Jesus, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us."
But Jesus said, "Do not stop him, for no one who does a deed of power in my name will be able soon afterward to speak evil of me. Whoever is not against us is for us. For truly I tell you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you bear the name of Christ will by no means lose the reward."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Sally and Linus are walking home from school, and Sally says, "I would have made a good evangelist. You know that kid who sits behind me in school? I convinced him that my religion is better than his religion." "How'd you do that?" asked Linus. "I hit him with my lunchbox." Right? It'd be funny if it weren't so true. 10 years ago, 8 pastors in Fountain Hills decided to brandish their lunchboxes for 6 weeks of sermons about how their religion is better than anyone else's. And in one of the sermons, why it matters that Jesus is the only way, detail how everyone else is burning in a literal hell for all eternity. To be sure, they feign sadness that so many people are going to be hurled into a lake of fire, but scratch the surface, and it's obvious that they can barely contain their absolute glee that God is going to punish people with excruciating torture for all eternity. It begs the question, what is wrong with these people? Why are evangelicals such hateful, genocidal maniacs? And they're proud of it. Right now, on one of their websites, it declares, "We believe in the judgment of the wicked, leading them into eternal damnation and punishment." On another, they celebrate that those who reject Jesus' free gift of salvation will spend eternity in hell, separated from the Lord. And those who have done evil will enter eternal fire. And on one church's website, it lists one of their core values as an unconditional, "We support Israel." And Why would that be problematic? Well, despite the government of Israel committing what the United Nations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and anyone with eyes to see is genocide against Palestinian civilians, evangelicals are particularly callous and heartless towards Jews. Evangelical doctrine teaches that before Jesus can return in the second coming, the temple in Jerusalem has to be rebuilt. So, evangelicals are all gung-ho in supporting the government of Israel in commandeering the Temple Mount from Muslim control. Why? So the temple can be rebuilt. Never mind that evangelicals also believe, according to Revelation 20, that anyone whose name is not found written in the Book of Life, aka non-Christians or wrong-thinking Christians, will be thrown into the lake of fire. Whoops! Can you say bait and switch? Sorry, Israel, we only supported you as a means to our end. Sorry if you aren't smart enough to know that means your own destruction. So do you really think it's too harsh a question to ask, why are evangelicals such hateful, genocidal maniacs? Especially when the Jesus I choose to follow contradicts all of their exclusionary vindictiveness by living out values like mercy, unconditional love, siding with the oppressed, and, I don't know, forgiveness? The dissonance is unsettling, especially when it becomes weaponized into exclusion, cruelty, and dehumanization. Most of them let themselves off the hook emotionally by hiding behind the fig leaf of saying, oh, it's not me condemning them, it's God. But make no mistake, they love being the us in us versus them. The Bible says Jesus is the only way. I know I'm right. Everyone else is wrong. I don't know about you, but I'm getting my reward in heaven and all the rest of y'all can burn in hell. Well, bully for you. Picture again with me the scene from today's text. John looking for kudos from Jesus. Hey, Jesus, you'll be so proud of us. We ran this guy off for exercising demons in your name. Didn't we do great, huh? Jesus' response? A tongue lashing. Cut it out, you morons. You are not superior by virtue of being with me. Instead of demanding some compliance with rules, Jesus throws the doors of the community wide open by proclaiming that whoever is not against us is for us. Look, what I'd like to suggest that we embrace is a little thing called reality. The fancy word is pluralism, where diverse ethnic and religious groups maintain their own traditions and autonomy. And if there's hope for humanity in general, and our country in particular, it's exactly what we need to urgently embrace. Now, pluralism isn't directly mentioned, but it is alluded to in the Bible. In Exodus 20, God says, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Clearly, each tribe had its own god. And Yahweh's people were admonished to be loyal to their own god. But over the centuries, the idea emerged that the God of Israel was the ruler of the whole universe, who embraced even the people who did not know the Lord by name. Then, early Christians developed the notion that they had replaced the Jews as God's chosen people. Then came Islam, a third group of people claiming to be the people favored by this same universal God. And the rest, as they say, is history. Religious violence is the front page of every paper and the lead story on the internet. Everyone claiming their own special access to God and the total worthlessness of anyone who doesn't fit their criteria. "Now hang on a second there, pal," says the evangelical. "I know the Bible says Jesus is the only way, and that's why he wants us to take America back for true Christians, just like the founders wanted." Hang on there, bald eagle breath. Before we get to the heresy of white Christian nationalism and the narcissistic Jesus in John, let's look at the earliest Gospels, shall we? There is precious little evidence in Mark, Matthew, or Luke that Jesus was trying to begin a new religion or is even calling for converts. To the contrary, Jesus' relationship with Samaritans and Gentiles seems to indicate an openness and pluralism that would have been unusual for any first century Jew. Where we get to the trouble is in, not surprisingly, John. Jesus is quoted as saying, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Let's remember, when these words were written, Jesus' followers were a bedraggled sect struggling for survival. The author of John was not opposed to amping up some Jesus sayings to give the group a little more advantage in the marketplace of religious claims. However, since the 4th century and the advent of Christendom, these words and other quotations from the book of John have been used as a source of power, control, and exclusivity by the church and the state. As just one example, the Pope used them in the 15th century's Doctrine of Discovery to give Christian explorers the right to rape, pillage, murder, and steal their way across the New World out of Christian love. Which is in part why Howard Thurman said, "For 2,000 years, the church has been in the habit of betraying Jesus." When Jeff Proctor Murphy and I were interviewing Brian McLaren for our Saving Jesus series, we asked him what he thought about Jesus being the only way.
Well, John 14:6 gets pulled out like a gun, you know, whenever somebody talks about how do we respond to people of other religions. John 14:6, Jesus says, "I'm the only way." And what's so ironic is you would think that John 14:5 would read like this. "And Thomas said to Jesus, 'What about people of other religions, people who've never heard about you, people who don't believe in you? Will they go to hell?' And Jesus said, 'I am the way, the truth.'" But that's not what John 14:5 says. Thomas says, "We don't know what you're talking about, you know? We don't know where you're going. How will we know the way?" So he's not talking about other people, he's talking about himself. So the first thing is to get clear that John 14:6 is not answering a question about other religions. It's answering a question for the disciples who are confused themselves. But then what's even more interesting is when you go to John 14:7, 8, and 9, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." And then Philip says, "Well, show us the Father. That will be enough for us." Jesus says, I mean, he must go, "Oh gosh, you know, Philip, have I not been with you so long and you don't know me? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." So if you want to go to that passage to say, how will God treat people of other religions? Then you say, how did Jesus treat people of other religions? And Jesus didn't kill them, and Jesus didn't hate them, and Jesus didn't reject them like his disciples wanted him to. He loved them, he accepted them, he met their needs, he served them. So when people want to ask me from John 14:6 how to treat people of other religions, I would say, well, as a follower of Jesus, I want to treat people of other religions the way Jesus did, with love or with respect. When I love my neighbor who's Muslim, or my neighbor is Jewish, or my neighbor is atheist, or my neighbor is Buddhist, when I love my neighbor and I treat my neighbor the way I would want them to treat me, I don't think I'm being unfaithful to Jesus. I think I'm being faithful to Jesus. What I'm being unfaithful to is a kind of religious conquest mentality that's a lot more like the Roman Empire. You know, the Roman Empire says, you either submit to us or we defeat you. You know? Now, if you're a person of another religion and I'm faithful to Jesus, then I will love you as I love myself. Now, that will also mean that the treasures I've received from Jesus, the blessing I've received from Jesus, I want to share. And you know what? If you're Buddhist or you're Muslim or you're Hindu and you have some treasures you want to share with me, I want to receive them as well. Part of being a neighbor is sharing your treasures. So to me, that's a much healthier way to think about what it means to be a Christian. I have strong Christian identity as a follower of Jesus. That's who I am. I don't hide that under a bushel. I love Jesus. I've devoted my life to Jesus. But that, I think, should make me a better neighbor so that my neighbors think, boy, I'm so glad I have a neighbor who follows Jesus, you know, rather than thinking, oh no, you know, here comes the guy who's always hassling us, you know. Anyway, that's how I see it.
Look, it used to be that if you lived your whole life in your town or village, you'd go through life without ever meeting a person of another religion. If you were a Christian, you might meet a Jew, but you weren't likely to meet a Hindu or a Muslim or a Buddhist or anything else. And now, in many places around the world, you could meet people from most of the world's major religions before breakfast. Can I just ask you to be honest? You're living as a pluralist already. If you really believe Jesus is the only way and were convinced that people are being cast into hell every day because they haven't come to know Jesus, and you haven't quit your job and gone out there trying to convert them, what does that say about you, you heartless, callous thing? But still, in conversation with Christians who say Jesus is the only way, you back off and you let them get away with their white Christian nationalist BS because you don't want an argument. And every time we let that go, we let religious bullies who don't understand their faith continue to betray Jesus. Not convinced? If we were to take the whole lot of them to a psychiatrist because they took pleasure in the suffering of innocent people, they would likely be diagnosed with sadistic, narcissistic personality disorder, probably trapped in an authoritarian personality structure. They, one, see the world in black and white, two, crave strong leaders so they don't have to think for themselves, and three, are hostile toward those who don't conform. Sound familiar? When you take all of these behaviors, which are bad enough in an individual, and you reinforce them socially in large groups, you get whole churches, and dare I say it, political movements like MAGA and white Christian nationalism. And yes, these are otherwise good people, your neighbors, co-workers, maybe even your family, who are able to compartmentalize their everyday life from beliefs that advocate unimaginable cruelty. And because of the deep-seated fear baked into their lives, helping someone out of that mindset is virtually impossible. A good therapist, or if you're a friend of theirs, might plant a seed of cognitive dissonance by asking, how does it feel to imagine people you love in that kind of torment? Or can a God of unconditional love also create eternal torment? And maybe somewhere down the line, they might realize that their answer really feels awful and needs to be thought about more deeply. But it's slow work, especially because if people feel something slipping away, they'll often cling harder than ever. Remember, these are the same people that were wrong on slavery, on opposing women's right to vote, on civil rights, on LGBTQ plus rights, and on every other issue the Christian right has ever taken up. Some of them still haven't changed their minds. So, all the more reason why we need to stick to the values Jesus has taught. Compassion, questioning the status quo, and modeling a generative, inclusive kind of faith. To paraphrase Karen Armstrong, the one and only test of a valid religious idea, doctrinal statement, spiritual experience, or devotional practice is that it must lead directly to practical compassion. If your understanding of the divine makes you kinder, more empathetic, and compels you to express this sympathy in concrete acts of loving kindness, this is good theology. But if your notion of God makes you unkind, belligerent, cruel, or self-righteous, or if it leads you to kill in God's name, it's bad theology. Compassion is the litmus test for the prophets of Israel, for the rabbis of the Talmud, for Jesus, for Paul, and for Muhammad, not to mention Confucius, Lao Tzu, the Buddha, or the sages of the Upanishads. Friends, let me assure you, the mystery of the divine is big enough, mysterious enough, to offer different pathways towards wholeness, enlightenment, and solutions to our ragged human condition, regardless of what a bunch of insecure, short-sighted religious bullies think. The divine is too big for one religion. And by embracing that reality, we don't weaken our faith, we broaden and deepen our understanding, empathy, and interconnectedness with all of humanity. Let me close by paraphrasing a sermon John Wesley preached 275 years ago about today's passage from Mark. He called it a caution against bigotry. If I were to see a Catholic, a Unitarian, or a Presbyterian casting out devils, I could not forbid even them without convicting myself of bigotry. Yea, if it could be supposed that I should see a Jew, an atheist, or a Muslim doing the same. Were I to forbid them either directly or indirectly, I should be no better than a bigot still. Oh, stand clear of this. In every instance of this kind, whatever the instrument be, acknowledge the finger of God. And not only acknowledge, but rejoice in God's work and praise God's name with thanksgiving. Encourage whomsoever God is pleased to employ. Speak well of those persons wherever you are. Defend their character and their mission. Enlarge as far as you can their sphere of action. Show them all kindness in word and deed, and cease not to cry to God for mercy on their behalf. Like the disciples in our story today, like the writer of John's Gospel, and like the pompous, pious pastors of Fountain Hills, we may find a certain security in believing that our way is the only way. But John Wesley would call you a bigot. Jesus would call you a bigot too. So, don't be a bigot. Worse yet, don't be a hateful, genocidal maniac. Be a follower of Jesus. With confidence and humility, devote yourself to the truth that only when we embrace the world in all its diversity are we fulfilling the call of Jesus in our lives. May we find the courage to resist the hate and exclusivity of so many. And putting love first, show what following Jesus is really all about. Be well.
Hey, and if you like what you heard today, buy me a coffee.
Shukran,
Atul. Shukran, Pinkin. Julie.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.